The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, we're on Amazon, we're on Stitcher, however you consume your podcasts. We're up there. We would love it if you subscribe. We'd love it even more if you were so inclined, if you left us a review. We are under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter at WWKUCIFM. We're on Facebook, Writers on Writing KUCI. We have websites, penonfire.com and mariestone.com. That is all the housekeeping stuff. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. And we're doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We bill ourselves as a mini free MFA show taught by talented authors every week. And that's exactly what today's book is, a whole hour with one of my living literary heroes, George Saunders, teaching through this book, a masterclass on Russian authors. George Saunders is the author of 11 books, including Lincoln and the Bardo, which won the 2017 Man Booker Prize for Best Work of Fiction in English and was a finalist for the Golden Man Booker, in which one Booker winner is selected to represent every decade from the 50 years since the prize's inception. The audiobook for Lincoln and the Bardo, which featured a cast of 166 actors, won the 2018 Audi Award for Best Audiobook. The story collection, 10th of December, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the inaugural Folio Prize in 2013 and the Story Prize. He's received a MacArthur and a Guggenheim Fellowship, and in 2013 was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time Magazine. He's taught in the creative writing program at Syracuse University since 1997 and is a graduate of that program. He's been a guest of mine twice before, the first time in 2013 for 10th of December and again in 2017 for Lincoln and the Bardo. You can find those interviews in our archives. So that's all the official bio. The unofficial addendum that I'll add to that with a caveat that I don't know George beyond our past interviews and me following him to every live literary event within 100 miles of wherever I am. He just strikes me as an incredibly decent and moral and compassionate human who I've sort of in the last 4 years found myself turning to as this, what would George do, psychological compass. And many times I thought, God, it would have been so cool to have a class from George Saunders. And then this book kind of landed like a gift. So it is A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. It's a 400-page masterclass taught by George and four Russian guys. It's a little mini MFA in a book. It's published by Random House, and it's what we're going to talk about today. George, welcome back.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you. Third time. It's really wonderful.
Third time. So before we dive into the book, I should let listeners know that we're recording this on Monday, January 18th, and in 2 days, I don't know a lot, but I do know we're going to have another president, but I don't know. There's some other unknowns beyond that. And I only bring that up because there's an anecdote in the books, like somewhere in the middle, about this flight that you once took that hit a flock of birds. And, you know, there's smoke pouring into the cabin and the flight crew's not giving you many reassurances and the ground's coming up on you. And as I was reading this, I thought, God, it'd be so cool if I was on a plane going down to be seated next to George Saunders. And then I thought, you know, it's January 18th and who knows what, you know, the cabin's kind of filling with smoke and I kind of am sitting next to George Saunders. So in the spirit of that story, I would turn to you like the little boy did and say, you know, is this all supposed to be happening? Is this how it's supposed to happen? I don't know how you're feeling these days.
You know, I'm feeling kind of stunned and almost a little bit, I don't know what the word would be. I wasn't going to say elated, but it's just amazing that this is all happening and that we get to witness it. And, you know, I've been trying for the last few years just to kind of be a little quiet and watch the world and listen to it the way a writer should and not be too quick to judge or to despair or to, you know, to be hopeful, just to kind of let the data come in. So this is, I don't have much wisdom to impart except just to say, you know, what I said to that kid was I lied. I said, yeah, it's supposed to be like this, you know, and that calmed him down a little bit. So maybe I should say, yeah, no, this is fine. Totally normal. No worries.
Exactly how
the Republic is strong.
Right. Well, it's funny because there's been a bunch of times over the last 4 years, well, especially over the last year when I kind of sit down to write or read and I think, you know, kind of what's it all for, Alfie? But this book makes such a strong case for fiction as a way to exercise the empathy muscle. And one of the things that I was going to say about this book is not only is it a great read for writers and readers alike, it's just kind of, you know, I mean, it's not a self-help guide, obviously, but it's a way to look at the world, I think, and look at other people with a lot more compassion and empathy and putting yourself in their position and whatnot. So in addition to everything else, it is, I would say it's kind of a neat guide to life, or at least a neat lens through which you can look at the world in a slightly more benevolent way.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I found myself using it that way. You know, I was going up to my shed with all this stuff going on, and sometimes I would have that same feeling, like, why am I not writing something more pointedly political? But I think, you know, in times like this, it's sometimes good to kind of just sort of make sure that you're okay, you know, and that you have confidence in your basic faculties and in human goodness and in your own ability to connect with people. And I, if I'm being really honest, that's kind of why I write, is that every time I do that, I just feel a little more substantial as a person, a little more generous. And so maybe it's just a mental form of working out, so that when you do go out into the fray, you're in a better condition.
Well, we could all use that. So I'm going to let you formally introduce the book, because you'll do a better job at it. I mean, my little informal introduction is, yes, like I said, it's a book for writers and readers, but it's a lot more. I've bought 3 copies of it so far. So I'm handing it out to everybody I know.
That's very nice of you. Yeah. I mean, you know, my approach has always been, you know, I kind of came to writing a little late and from a weird angle. So the one thing I learned pretty quickly was, Toby Wolf reminded me of this the other day. Our mutual friend Michael Hare once said that should is an enemy to artists. So, and I think I would add must is an enemy to artists. So I've always had this feeling of kind of just scanning to see what I would like to write about, and then not worrying too much about whether it's, you know, going to be good, or it's going to be justified, or it's sufficient. Just, you know, is your heart telling you to do a certain thing? And my experience has been that if the answer is yes, if your heart does want to do it, then you're going to find a lot of buried resources once you get into the thick of it, you know? So this book, the Lincoln and the Bardo came out, and there's a lot of traveling and talking about it. And that's sometimes can make your artistic self a little blurry. You know, you've been pontificating so much that you forget to be uncertain. So I just had a strong instinct that I would want to do a book where I go back to the basics, you know, and just pretend I don't know anything about fiction. Maybe even pretend I don't like it. Just pretend like I don't have any investment in continuing it. Then going into the fiction that I've loved the best in my life, which is these Russian stories from the 19th century. And in a way, just kind of hoping to rekindle my faith in the form a little bit. And I didn't really know how I was going to do that, except I thought I would try to model it on my classes. So that meant one of the prerequisites was you, the reader, have to have the text first. You know, you were going to read it together and then talk about it. And it kind of went from there.
I heard you say that you're kind of scaling back on your teaching. So this was sort of a way to leave, this was, I think, one of your favorite classes that you were teaching. This was sort of a way to leave a document of what you're doing. So you are cutting back on teaching? Are you turning more into writing?
Well, yeah. I mean, Syracuse has been really good to me, and they let me pull my teaching back to where I'm just teaching the graduate workshop for the third year students in the fall, and that's it. So that's great for a writer standpoint. It's fantastic. And it's kind of what, you know, I guess we're all work towards our whole lives to get a life that's nothing but writing. But also, you know, I found it was a little sad because I love teaching this course, and I loved actually teaching year round and that kind of interaction with the students. So at one point when it became clear that the teaching was being cut back, I just had this moment of going, oh, wow, that, you know, teaching has really been part of your life, a very honorable, beautiful part of your life. And, you know, even a kind of a bear of little brain like me, you kind of accumulate certain insights. And this Russian class, which I've been teaching for 20 years to all these great young writers, there's quite a, I thought anyway, quite a buildup of information that I had in my head and in this one little folder I've been keeping. And it did kind of hit me that, you know, maybe a little morbidly, that if I kicked off, you know, then that is all gone, which is fine. But combined with the idea that I kind of wanted to go back to the woodshed, it would seem like a nice thing to turn my mind to that class, you know, and these stories and go, how does the story work anyway? Like, why do we bother? Why do we keep reading once we start? How is it that these completely invented little word fragments stay with us forever? And they actually impact the way we act, you know, and the things that we believe and the way we live.
So tell me a little bit about what it is about the Russians. Because I agree, there is something about the Russians, and, you know, it's certainly the kind of classic literature that we turn to, but I'm trying to figure out what it is about them. Because a lot of these stories were really quiet, you know, I mean, if you were to scale out the plot, which you did, kind of quiet stories. And so I'm kind of wondering what their enduring appeal is from your perspective.
Yeah. I mean, on the most honest level, I just love reading them and love teaching them, because they get a certain thing going in the classroom that no other stories I've ever taught does. Just a kind of, you know, the line between this is an artistic artifact and this is a philosophical object gets totally blurred. And, you know, one minute we're talking about structure, the next minute we're talking about morality. So I think that's exciting, just to have a class of grad students coming face to face with the idea that a story actually can be a kind of moral ethical document, if you want to call it that. You know, it actually is not supposed to be separate from the things that keep you awake at night or the things that make you happy or all that. So that is really why. I think the reason they do that is because it was sort of, you know, an implicit understanding in the right of time that's what literature was for. It was kind of the movies of their time. It was also kind of the pop music of their time. It was so important to people. And I think these handful of great writers just kind of, you know, walked up to the bar and said, let's talk about the big questions. So formally, they're pretty simple. And as you say, they're quiet. They tend to operate mostly realistically, but even when not realistically, they kind of confine themselves to the quotidian. You know, these are actual people in certain clothes walking around talking and thinking. And so they actually pay quite a deal of attention to the internal life of people. And one of the things I'm interested in is that if you have a hearty enough representation of a character's internal life, then plot gets easy, because as soon as for example, you and I have a knowledge of our respective internal lives, and plot is happening all the time. You know, if I go out and slip and fall on the ice, oh my God, that's me, you know, falling on the ice. And that's plot. You know, the guy who, for example, just has a book out and thinks very well of himself, bam, down he goes. Pretty interesting. So I think that's one of the things they do, is they take very seriously the relation between, say, internal monologue and outer world, which I find really truthful. I think that's, my life has been a series of internal mental events, often in conflict with external reality.
Yeah, it made me think, if young writers or American writers, I don't know, if kind of newer writers tend to rely on too much on like shock value or cramming a bunch of stuff in for the sake of something happening as a substitute for these sort of, you know, harder psychological work of human subtlety, which is what these stories did so well. It's funny because, you know, I don't have an MFA. So a lot of these stories I was coming to for the first time, and I found myself a little like Kramer in Seinfeld with the movie phone. I'm like, well, George, why don't you just tell me what this story is about?
Yeah. Well, they're quiet. You know, they're quiet. And one of the things that happens in class that I really love is that it's not the case that all the students love all these stories. And, you know, of course, what you learn as a teacher is that that's fine. What you can't work with is indifference, you know, like, but if somebody really loves a story, you can work with that. If somebody really hates a story, you can work with that. It's almost like judo, you know, you need some energy to work with. So my whole approach to the class was teach these stories that I love, make a really strong case for why I love them, and then allow any reaction. You know, if a student agrees with me, that's great, and wants to continue the praise. But some of the best classes, for example, there's a story in the book called The Singers, which the kids usually hate. It's really slow, and it's got a really old-fashioned voice. That's a fantastic place to, it's one of the best classes of the year every time, because when someone says, I really hated this story, you can say, all right, great. You just told me something important about your aesthetic. We can work with that, you know. So that my thought was with my part of the book, which is the essays that kind of run after the stories, is to say, I'm going to make a really strong case, the most persuasive case I can for my reading of the story. But that's not the end of what we're doing here. Now, then after that, you reader, dear reader, get to react to that. And it's in that reaction where I think if the book is helpful to writers, it's in that reaction, you know. And as I say at the end of the book, if you had a strong reaction against what I said, that's fantastic, because that's where we're going to find the key to your aesthetic approach.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they can kind of learn their own? Yeah, I guess so. They're kind of learning their own voice and style through another writer in a way.
Yeah, in this case, they're kind of learning it. I mean, I hope what I'm doing is, I always think of it as shaking a cage. Like, you know, when we're writing, any of us, every one of us has some obstructions going on. We always think that there are secret obstructions, shameful obstructions that only we have, and that we're defective in having them, you know. Well, in fact, the obstructions are totally tied in with our strengths. They always are. They're almost like, you know, the two faces, you know, on either side of a mask. So part of the teacher's job, I think, is to shake the cage and say, okay, admit what your obstructions are. Don't be ashamed of them. Admit them. And let me throw some ideas at you to get you unobstructed, knowing that about 9 out of 10 won't work. Maybe none of them will work, but you're sort of, I think of it as in the classroom, you know, there's 25 incredibly talented students sitting there. They're all blocked up in some way or another, and they all think it's their fault. You know, when we start talking about these Russian stories at a kind of high volume with a lot of passion, my theory is that whatever is blocking you in particular, that the conversation is going to go like a laser into that part of yourself, and it's going to kind of hit it with energy, which might help you solve it. So the only prerequisite is that the conversation has to be energetic, and you have to participate in it, and then something will get shaken loose. That's the theory anyway, you know, and you can sometimes see it happening. You can see somebody, you know, in the middle of a discussion, you see their eyes get wide and they're not talking anymore, but you can see that they're processing something. So I don't really know how all this teaching works, but I think it's basically me saying what I believe and then letting that energy go out into the room and cause a little ruckus.
I don't know how I missed this, but I never knew or I forgot that you were an engineer in your prior life and went to the Colorado School of Mines before turning to writing. And you can really see that engineering mind at play in the book. You know, I mean, a lot of the stories you kind of deconstruct in an outline way or in tables or mathematically. And I hadn't really thought of deconstructing a story as a kind of a mathematical equation, but it worked so well. And it made certain things that would have been elusive to me forever so much clearer. So if you can talk a little bit about how that old life helps your new life.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. I do. And in fact, in class, I kind of clown it up a little bit I do a lot of figures and drawings and stuff. And my thought is that the story form is kind of mathematical. Now, we have to always be a little careful about this because we can get into the trap of being reductive about this. But, you know, when you think of the fact that you pick up a story and it says once upon a time, and there's 6 pages after that, you kind of know that the document is making a claim to be efficient, for example. It's claiming that it's going to give you some kind of jolt in those 8 pages. Okay, so we know efficiency is a de facto assumption of the form. We also know that from reading, somehow specificity is something that we really thrive on. You know, if we say this one guy walked into this one vague place, there's nothing for your reading mind to cohere to there. But if we say Jim slouched into the filthy cellar, suddenly you're in a particular place. So my theory is that there are certain laws, not rules, but laws in the sense of physics by which reading works. You know, a certain text pulls us in and other texts don't. And as writers, it kind of compels us to, at least for ourselves, figure out, well, what is it that, you know, when I am standing in a bookstore and I pick up this new book and I can't put it down, what is it that's keeping me in there exactly? And the answer is different for every person, but it behooves us to know the answer for ourselves. So the engineering approach is partly a little bit of fun that I'm having because I have a pretty orderly mind, at least on the surface. But it also, I think it has to do with the form. The form actually does work by certain conventions. And if we can admit to those, I think we can get more quickly to the place where we're doing something unique within those conventions. So it's like a song. I mean, you can say, oh, I don't care about melody or rhythm, but in fact, you kind of do, you know, kind of, I would say, biologically or organically you do. Now you can resist it, but even efforts to resist, say, melody and stuff, they work on the assumption that the melody exists. You know, if you have an atonal song, part of the fun of it is that you are aware of how out of step it is with your expectation of melody, you know.
Right.
Or like, you know, if a dancer can't say gravity doesn't exist. You know, she has to say, right. Oh God, does it ever? Now watch what I do in opposition to it. It's a play between me and gravity.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there was so much comfort in here because there wasn't, I guess nothing jumped out as like enormously surprising, but the way you cast a lot of the observations just made me look at things in a different way. And my subsequent readings of other things make me read things in a different way. So I guess that, you know, that's really the goal. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah. And there was a lot of comfort just in, okay, let's take away all the rules about plot and dialogue and all that stuff and just say, you know, the engine of the story is, do I want to keep reading? Does something happen that I want to keep reading? And, you know, this idea of transferring energy. I love there's an image in here about these little Hot Wheel cars that you had as a kid. And, you know, they gas themselves up at little intervals and that delivers the energy of the story. And I've kept that in my head as I've sat down to my own writing. Of, you know, we better get to a gas station pretty soon because the story's
yeah,
energy.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because I was a working class person. I was an engineer first, so all the writing stuff was so intimidating to me, and I loved fiction so much, which is another thing that intimidates us. You know, this oversized respect for the craft, so it can really freeze you up. And I know a lot of young writers who get frozen up around these technical things like plot and theme and 3X structure and all that. And I basically think there's nobody, including me, who really knows anything about how fiction works. It's a beautiful mystery in life. And you know, that's why we're so enthralled to it, because it's just unknowable. As soon as you say, here's exactly how to do it, you will almost guarantee that you can't do it. You know, it's too vast. So that means we can put aside the job of saying, here's how it's always done, or here's how you must do it. And we can say, let me throw out some stuff to see if I can help you. You know, so all these different models and metaphors, they're just meant to be stimuli, really. And I found with my students that to kind of deconstruct all that nonsense that has to do with should and must is helpful, because everybody who's a writer is in it for an honest reason, which is at some point in their life, a book kicked their ass. So I think we can retrace the steps and say, well, why did it? You know, why did that first book make you change your life? We can actually, you know, we can break those reasons down and then try to re-inhabit them. It's like, you know, when you're a kid, you know, like when I was a kid, I really liked being funny. I was kind of a class clown. That's, you know, that's a holy impulse. That was a very organic impulse. When we go back and trace, what is it that first brought me into this? The seeds of our actual development are going to be found there. And I think so many times these rules and prohibitions and stuff, they just put a kind of conceptual wall between you and whatever your authentic charms are. And those authentic charms are actually what we have to rely on the page. It's somebody, when they buy your book, they want to see a distilled version of the wonder that is you. Mm-hmm. And the way we get there is by revising. So anyway, I guess what I'm, as a teacher, I'm always trying to be hopeful, because otherwise, how can a person do their best work? You know, if they're discouraged and intimidated and oppressed, I don't think that's the way to do it.
Well, it's funny because so much of reading the book kind of put me at ease. But then I thought, well, it's a little bit like, you know, the behind the scenes magic shows that they used to show. They're like, we're going to show you exactly how the trick is done, and they show you, and then they hand you the cups and balls, and they're like, here, do it, and you know, you can't.
Right. Well, and that's another part of the book that I stumbled on and was kind of excited about, was to say, you know, this world that we live in of MFAs and craft talks and everything, there's kind of an implicit misleading thing in there, which is to say all you need is craft, you know. But we all know that's not exactly true. You need this kind of mysterious thing that's called talent that isn't actually doled out equally. So I think you do the craft to see if you have a rare talent. You can't know it before you do the craft and do the thousands of hours of work. But part of that is this, you know, part of the noble hunt is to say, I might not, you know, or I might have it and I might lose it. That's a really important part that I think sometimes gets glossed over in the kind of business of writing instruction. We don't talk about that, but it's important. And I think, you know, that a life in art is ultimately a life of being trained in realism, because if you want to write a beautiful book, you either will or won't, but you have to be realistic along the way. And one of the things is to say, some of it's in our control. That's called craft, and it's called our work, and some of it isn't. And that's okay. You know, in the MFA, there's always I give this speech in class. I say, you know, that most of you won't publish, and most of you won't publish well. You won't have a life in writing. Now, when you do it in an MFA program, everybody looks at their colleagues and goes, yeah, you poor saps, you know, but it's kind of important to disconnect, you know, being a good writer and being a good person are two totally separate things. So, you know, I think we enter into it by saying, I really want to get published, but if I don't, I'm not going to let that undercut my belief in my own value as a human being. I mean, they're two very different skills, and we shouldn't confuse them.
Right. Well, you made that point with Tolstoy, as Tolstoy is considered a moral, ethical person. And his wife had other things to say about that, right? She was like, actually, not really so much.
But, yeah.
but I kind of liked that you can be kind of a higher elevated you through your art that maybe you aren't in real life. And to your point, you can also be a really good person and, you know, maybe kind of a crappy artist. So, but I like that idea that your ego shouldn't be linked to your craft. Cause I think that's where a lot of people get derailed, where they're like, well, I guess I'm just crap.
Yeah, that's terrible. Because, you know, the other thing is, as somebody who's taught a lot of writers, and you see every combination, you see lovely people who publish well, you see lovely people who never publish, you see, you know, people who are somewhat flawed as individuals publishing well, and so on. So I think part of it is to say there is a mindset that's involved in getting published. I have it. And it's something like, I always think of it as there's two circles. One is truth, the things you want to say, your view of the world. And the other one is what can get published, you know, what's accessible to other people. People who get published, those two circles have an intersection. But if you imagine someone for whom those two circles don't intersect, the understanding of life is still 100% valid. You know, she just can't get it into a form that would be publishable or that would be necessarily accessible to somebody else. So I think it's really important to do that. And if no other reason, you'll do your best work if you don't cling to the idea of publishing too much, I think. If you don't, you know, kind of try to hit that target too slavishly, because that's not going to encourage your best self to appear on the page. Although, you know, like I say, for those of us who, like I always want to get published, and that is constantly with me as I work on myself. I'm never doing some kind of abstract thing. I'm definitely aiming for that target. So it's, I don't know, it's tricky.
Is there a point along the road where you would say writers should sort of reassess? How long do you have to get down the road before you say, maybe this isn't for me?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it depends on, you know, I think, now I say this, I don't know if I would ever do it, but I think there's value in writing fiction, even if you never get published.
Yeah.
I think it, you know, but I don't know that I would do it if I stopped getting published. But I think the reassessment, my thought is that reassessment should happen every day, and it should be positive. Like, okay, here I am. I'm not dead yet. I still love these handful of great writers. I still have a chance to be up there with them. You know, that kind of reassessment is really healthy, because what it does is it allows you to disentangle from your preconceptions about what kind of writer you are. I think that's one of the biggest nets, is you know that you're the person who writes about Slovenia or whatever, you know, or you know you're a comic writer, or you know you're this. And those concepts are often so complicated you couldn't even pronounce them, but you have some idea of who you are. When you sit down in the morning, you have a fresh chance to engage with that which you've actually done. And there's an amazing opportunity for liberation from those preconceptions about yourself. So I think, yeah, I reassess. I mean, I kind of lovingly disavow anything I've ever done up until this point, because I know I can do better, and tomorrow I'm going to do it. You know, again, this is sort of a self-gaming thing where I just tell myself that, because the odds are it will make me more productive.
My guest this morning is George Saunders, the book, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. There was a lot of comfort in this idea that, first of all the work pretty much happens in the revision process. I mean, you got to get a little bit of clay onto the table to work with, but from there, it's really all about the revision process. And you had this other great image that I've kind of kept in my head about, you know, if you have an apartment and you're allowed to decorate it and make changes to it for a couple of years, that's what a story is. You can, you know, move the end table from this side of the room to that side. You can make 1,000,000,000 changes, and every day you come to it and make it a little more perfect. And for some reason, that kind of freed my mind up from, well, that was a crappy sentence, so I guess I can't do it. You know, you got to move on. I think that was a helpful thing to hear, that you've got infinite time and infinite, well, not infinite time, sadly, but a lot of time to, you know, to get it right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, then, and the thing that I find exciting about that is you don't have to have a big plan. You just have to be willing to show up and be the self that you are that day. And then you make some adjustments, and every one of those adjustments theoretically infuses a little more of you into the story, you know? And as we said, that's kind of what the reader is paying for, is to see you. They want to see you in your full glory. So for me, that was a big moment. I had a lot of anxiety about having to, quote unquote, decide what kind of writer I was going to be, and what, you know, this revision, if this is a mode of revision that makes you happy, it's a way of of infinitely deferring that decision, or, you know, you're locating the decision within those thousands of small decisions you make every day. And then one day you look up and you go, oh, there I am, you know? Yeah. So to me, again, this, it just takes the pressure off. I hated that feeling, still hate that feeling of having to pre-control a story so that it would be considerable. I can't do it. It just depresses me and it makes me want to quit. Whereas if I just keep saying to myself, well, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good. Let's go in there and try to make it marginally better, you know, do that every day. And then there's a kind of interesting process that comes into play from underneath almost. And the story will start telling you things and it will sort of self-elevate. But for me, the whole trick is just saying, look, the whole job is start reading this thing, see how I like it, make a few changes, even if they're tiny. A tiny change can sort of prepare the way for a bigger change. So it might be a little bit like if you walk into a really messy house, you know, and you're like, oh my God, what's my plan? How am I going to get this thing clean? That's anxiety provoking. Whereas you say, oh, look, there's a dirty sock on the stove. Let me take that off of there. You know, then, you know, you've made it a better house already. You know?
Right. And to your earlier point, if you go into it with an agenda of I'm going to tell you something I believe, or I'm going to, you know, be didactic about it or something, it's just death on the page, right? I mean, if you already have an idea of what you want your reader to think about something, it's no good.
Right. Yeah. And I compare that to a conversation. You know, if I came into our talk here today with a bullet point of things I wanted to impose on you, the conversation is dead because you are going to correctly feel that I'm not here for you, you know? So I think for me, again, that was one of those simple ideas that really helped me with writing, because I know how to do that in person, you know? Yeah. And in fact, I've had to learn it. I was kind of a keen splainer, I guess, you know? And so over the years, I kind of learned, yeah, you can actually listen to somebody else. So that's another thing where there's an analog between a life skill and a writing skill. And if you come into your story saying, I don't really know what it's about, I don't know what it's supposed to sound like, and you decide by these micro decisions, what's beautiful is you're kind of temporarily occupying the mind of your reader all along the way. You're saying, what would she think of me? What would she be moved by this development? Would this sentence surprise her? And in turn, in a kind of weird way, it opens you up to a better or higher version of yourself, which I'm a little hesitant to say that, but let's say a different version of yourself. Yeah. You know, when you've gone through your story 300 or 400 times, you're going to find that the jokes are funnier because you've already discarded a whole bunch of not so funny ones. You're going to find that the pace is faster, which conveys a kind of narrative intelligence that you're not capable of in real time. So the whole thing for me is kind of tied together, but the watchword for me is communication. You're really trying to communicate with somebody, not preach to them or sort of tap dance in front of them, but get into a kind of mind meld with somebody that you have respect for, the reader. Right.
It's probably worthwhile to highlight a couple of the things that writing advice wise that I thought was yet again, another really cool way to recast something in my brain that helped out. And the big one was causality, the importance of just not throwing a bunch of stuff into a story and having stuff happen, but having one thing lead to the other. And I do think that gets lost, at least in early drafts of stories, that, you know, just a bunch of stuff happens and they're not really linked together in sort of a, you know, psychologically satisfying sort of way. So yeah, that was helpful.
Yeah. And I think it's helpful I have to remind myself that causality is not something you put in there, but in a weird, again, totally mysterious way, what I find is causality reveals itself through revision. Partly because you're kind of hope you're rooting for it. You know, you're like, okay, I've got scene one, scene two, and scene three. They're all pretty good, but they seem a little unrelated. And then again, I always think it's best not to be too harsh, but you just notice it like, I noticed that, I noticed that scene two, it doesn't seem to be in relation to one and three. Anything you guys can do about that? You know, and that is all tied in with me with the process of making the prose sharper, you know, making things corner sharper, making jokes better, making the dialogue more snappy. And then sort of, again, sort of miraculously by doing that, suddenly I'll go, oh, I see. Scene two actually does have a causal relation to scene three. So it's kind of hard to talk about, but it's almost like, you know, there's a certain Darwinian quality to some of the stuff where you'll make causality accidentally the first time. You don't even know you're doing it. And then in rereading, you're like, oh God, that, you know, A causes B. Then once you've done it accidentally, your mind starts seeking it a little bit, not in a conscious way. You don't even have to worry about it. But if you've done it once, then you're ever after a little hopeful that it will happen again, which then in turn helps you do it. But again, I think it's kind of like another way of talking about causality is saying that a story is such a tight little document that really randomness isn't welcome, I guess you would say rather harshly. Or a better way to say it is the beauty of the story has to do with the sense, the after sense, that it's coherent, that every part of it has been considered. Now, not necessarily mathematically, but in an artistic way. Does this part feed the whole or not? So therefore, of course, you would want causality because you want everything in the story to be necessary. And the other thing I talk about in the book is to be escalatory. So, you know, ideally, the story is like a pot of water that gets put on the stove and gets hotter, hotter, hotter and boils. That's the perfect sort of Platonic story. So we're always kind of working in that direction. You know, we don't want a section of the story that totally flatlines because that feels somehow antithetical to the form. Now, again, one of the things I learned from teaching is this method of thinking of writing bums some people out. You know, some people don't, it's too technical and it makes them anxious. So if you're one of those, I say, just walk away, you know, but if there's anything, you know, in it for you, then, you know, you're welcome to it. So as a teacher at an MFA level, you have to be really sensitive to even the body language of your class. I give a little talk about publishing, like a real brass tacks thing about how to get published, how the money works. And a couple of years ago, one of my most talented students, I could just see her cringing at this. She was almost under the table, you know, and we talked afterwards and she said, for me, I can't even think about that. It takes all the joy out of it. So in the future, when I talked to her, we didn't, you know, we talked about what was amenable to her process.
Do you think that her, not obviously disinterest, but whatever, the publishing was obviously secondary or tertiary to what her goals were, was somehow linked to her being one of the more talented writers in your class? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if publishing is the goal, then...
Yeah, I think I wouldn't make that connection because I have other people who were as talented and really wanted to publish. It was just her, you know, I mean, these kids show up and they're just magical little combinations of talent and nerves and neuroses and, you know, so part of the job is to get to know the person so you can say the right things in front of them. You know, in her case, I don't really know psychologically what it was, but her work flourished when she was just being privately joyful, I think, you know. And so my job was just to then remember that and encourage that because she's right. If it works for her, then she's absolutely correct. You know, I think that the people who, it's really funny that how hard it is to generalize about students at that level. I've seen every incarnation of talented person.
The only reason I ask is because I thought maybe if your goal is to publish, you have something in the back of your brain that's kind of telling you this is what the market wants, or you have some imaginary reader that's imposing something that's not even accurate onto your head. And if you're off in your private corner saying, I'm doing this for myself, you're allowed to just let your voice be a little bit more natural or authentic.
100%. And I think, you know, that's the thing is the question is which, you know, for each of your listeners, which writer are you? Which combination of those two models feeds you? You know, I saw Frank Conroy came to Syracuse one time and I think we were talking about something like this, publishing or not. And, how, you know, can the idea of publishing get in your head and mess you up? And he did this amazing kind of thing. He wrote this, he drew this big arc on the board, like a rainbow. And at one end, he put a W for writer. And at the other end, he put R for reader. And he said, okay, every work of fiction exists somewhere on this arc. So if the dot is down here by the W, that's a work that the writer did only for the writer. She doesn't care a bit if anyone can access it. Doesn't care. And he said, you know, maybe like something on the order of Finnegan's Wake might be there. Or, you know, there are even more inscrutable documents that exist other places. So on the other end, there's a dot by the R for reader. This is the kind of big tent thing that anybody can read, like a sort of an airport thriller or whatever, you know. No, he said, now you're probably thinking that I'm telling you to put the dot right in the middle of those. He said, not at all. He said, what I want you to do is do your best work, see where it falls on the arc, and then take responsibility for that. So if you want to write something that's, you know, more inscrutable than Finnegan's Wake, God bless you. Go ahead. But don't be surprised when it's not on the bestseller list, you know, and conversely, if you want to write something, a big tent bestseller, don't be surprised when the critics don't take it seriously. You know, so he was sort of saying, and this is such a great advice, is the writer has to take responsibility for everything that she does. And part of that process is to say, and this is where I love that Flannery O'Connor quote. She says, basically a writer can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. Mm. So part of this thing is forget about deciding, just write in energetically in enough different modes, revise energetically in enough different modes so that one day you go, wow, this thing of mine really pops. People really respond to this, or I really respond to this. Then that tells you where you are in that arc. And that tells you everything about your process. But, you know, nobody else can tell you that. And I don't think you can decide on it in advance. You have to really submit to the result. You know, for me, it was finally realizing that when I was funny and a little bit irreverent, the energy just spiked in my stories. You know, before that, they were kind of nicely written, cautious realist things, but nobody would get excited about them, which was heartbreaking, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when I kind of let the scrim down and let more of my actual personality in it, people started responding, not always in a positive way per se, but they couldn't help but respond negatively sometimes, which is also good. You know,
right? Do you think that was a matter of time and confidence, or that was a matter of, oh, I just locked into my voice whenever I did and it just took off?
Yes, that was a lot of it. And then also it was just the trauma of being, I think I was 31 or something, and we had two kids and nobody gave a crap about what I was writing. And I couldn't stand that. You know, I sometimes say it's like if you were, you know, in an alley getting beat up by a smaller guy, and you're like, why am I getting beat? And then you notice that both your hands are behind your back. You know, I had all these gifts that I use in real life to get by, like sense of humor, mostly. Being sarcastic. I had all these interests that were actually compelling to me about materialism and corporatism and the workplace and all that. But I had been keeping all those things out of my work because I didn't think they were literary, so-called. And as soon as I got desperate enough, and I can, you know, there's a particular weekend when it happened, I just kind of went, F it. You know, I didn't even say that consciously. I just blurted out this thing on accident at work. I talk about it in the book. It was just some poem, some little Seussian poems that had no literary intention whatsoever. And those, you know, you look at the previous 7 years of writing, those are the most powerful thing I'd done. So it was by accident and by trauma and by kind of, impatience, I guess, or, you know, pain. Actually, it was just like, I can't stand, you know, I think all of us writers right. have that terrible feeling of when you know you're a fully developed person who's been through some things and has learned some hard lessons and is a good person at times, you know that. And then you read what you've written and there's no trace of that authentic you on the page. That's heartbreaking, you know? And I couldn't stand it anymore. And so, yeah.
There's kind of a corollary story you tell in here about, I think it's Tolstoy. There's an exercise you put in the book about, if you read Master and Man, he had an earlier short story that, you know, recounted a jaunt through the snow. And mm-hmm. your point was, you know, if you read this earlier story against the later story, you can see his development over those years and the choices he's made. And, you know, there was kind of some comfort in that, too, that even Tolstoy started out as, you know, a little less Tolstoy.
Yeah. Oh, very much. Yeah. I actually, in the book, there's a link to that story. And then I do the same thing with some Charlie Chaplin stuff. And I think, you know, one of the best things you can do is take a work like The Snowstorm. That was the early story. And then 30 years later, he wrote Master and Man. And in a way, all you have to do is read them back to back. You don't have to articulate anything, just read them and you'll feel something in the juxtaposition, which I, in the book, I say, you know, the second one is a more highly organized system, but you don't even have to say that. You just feel it. You know, there are qualities in, you know, a good song has a certain quality. A less good song has another kind of quality. I think artists can do a lot just by juxtaposing those things. I went to a songwriting seminar with this guy, Mike Smith, one time, who wrote a beautiful song called The Dutchman. And it was just at somebody's house in Rochester before I wrote my first book. And he said this really lovely thing, kind of jarring thing, actually. He said, when he writes a song, he just compares it to the work by his favorite songwriter, by Bob Dylan, you know, and the room just groaned like, oh God, you're always going to lose that. He goes, yeah, of course you're going to lose that. But it also is a very frank way of getting into your body, the difference between the work you're doing and the work you want to do. And the kind of shocking thing is you don't actually have to say anything about that. You don't have to make a do list afterwards. You don't have to articulate anything. You just have to put those two things in juxtaposition and let it sink in.
Do you feel like most of the kind of lessons that are in this book would apply equally to novel writing, or are these kind of specific to the short story? Is there, I mean, there's obviously a compression to the short story and a you can't have any of the randomness that you talked about that you kind of maybe can in the frolic and detour in the novel, but I assume the lessons all apply equally.
I think so. I think, you know, there's something I've noticed over the years. It goes back to that analogy of the water on in a pot on a stove. Most of us writers are pretty good at putting the water in the pot. So that would be exposition. You know, you start you write a long, kind of brilliant 4 pages about your childhood. What I think happens a lot is that people get stuck in the exposition and they can't enter the next phase of what's called Freytag's triangle, which is rising action. And, you know, we can kind of feel that moment in the story. It's like when you rub your hands together and go, "Ooh, this is going to be good." So, you know, Scrooge is a stingy guy. Okay, we get that. That's the exposition. Then Marley's ghost comes and says, "You're in deep trouble." That's the rising action, you know. Right. So that part, I've read whole student novels that were 400 or 500 pages of beautiful exposition, but the action doesn't rise, which is another way of saying that there's no causality at play, you know. So I think these principles do kind of generally apply to any kind of fiction where the imperative is to make complication, you know, make meaningful complication. So yeah, I think so. And certainly, like, I wrote one novel which some people aren't sure is a novel, Lincoln and the Bardo, but definitely the same principles. You know, you can't stay in stasis for too long. A given scene will create certain expectations in the reader, and that's your currency. You have to capitalize on those. I think those are general principles of narrative and film too, you know, same.
And it's so easy to get caught up in trying to write a beautiful sentence or trying to think of the right word, you know, and you get so stuck at the micro level that it's hard to get to the macro level of the Glengarry, Glenn Ross always be escalating.
Yeah. I think one of the things though is, you know, for me that when I think about things like escalate or cause, I that kind of freaks me out a little bit. So it's interesting to see for some of us, and for me, this is true, that the escalatory things and the plot things and the causal things actually can start on the sentence level. You know, for example, sometimes I'll have a sentence that, you know, it's okay. It's kind of just a normal English sentence, but it leaves me a little bit dissatisfied. It doesn't seem jazzy enough or something or compressed enough. And then in rearranging it for sound, they'll suddenly open up a kind of a rhythmic linking place at the end of the sentence where suddenly something new needs to go. So I don't think I can think of an example off the top of my head, but, you know, if I say, Bill walked into the meeting room feeling happy, to me, that sentence is, I don't know, I just don't like it. So then I say, okay, let me be a little more compressed and specific. Bill in the meeting room. Now suddenly I've made a space at the end of that sentence for an additional fact. Actually, Bill in the meeting room happy. Now there's a space there. And the way I would tend to fill it is not by meaning, but by sound. So Bill in the meeting room happy, panicked. Now I don't know what that even means, but I like the sound of it. So in a sense, we've just made plot. Bill's happy, but he panicked. For me, it's been a kind of a blessing to say, I don't have to overtly worry about plot causation, all these things that we identified as being desirable end products. But if I just focus on getting the sentences the way I want them to be, they actually do produce these things, you know, in the long run. Again, it's that dirty sock on the stove, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's another way of saying, you know, if you've read a ton, you can kind of trust yourself. You know, your body kind of knows.
But I think also one of the things we have to learn is that, you know, we each have something that we're crazy about in writing, or we wouldn't be in it. So for me, it's this kind of sentence level futzing around to make a sentence feel like it's mine, like it's uniquely mine. That's my thing. And now I know other people that have that. But first, I think we have to say that all writers have something different that overjoys them. You know, it might be structure, or it might be some other totally different way of thinking. It might be maybe thinking about plot, maybe thinking about politics. But part of the writer's journey is to say, okay, look, I'm not in this to be regular. I'm in it to be joyful. I'm in it to be exceptional. I'm in it because something about this really lights me up. And then it's that delicious moment of saying, even though in the rest of my life, I'm very dutiful and responsible and, you know, and polite, in this one area, I get to totally indulge my passions. You know, if I am a freak for semicolons, haha, this is where I'm going to do it. And I think that's actually where writers, they're more inclined to find, quote unquote, find their own voice by simply saying, I really love doing this. I really love this aspect of fiction. When I'm worrying about it in this way, my opinions get really strong. That's a strong position to come from. It's kind of liberating, I think.
Yeah, if you think about it more as play than as, you know, work or some sort of condemnation on your personality or who you are or something else.
Yes.
Yeah, the freedom of that is really fun.
And that's what people want. I think people want to see that. That, you know, they want to know, they pick up a book and they say, I know there's another human being on the end of this. Is it a special human being? And has she taken the trouble through craft to allow the specialness of herself to be presented? It's just like, you know, when you you see you're at a bar and you see back in the days when we could do that, and you see somebody dancing skillfully and joyfully, you know, who doesn't want to watch that? You don't even, you know, there's no ulterior motive. You're just like, wow, there's a human being really inhabiting herself, you know, or himself. That is, you know, we don't talk about that much in MFA world, but that's actually, I think, what you're doing when you go to see a band or go to hear a reading. You want to see somebody being radically themselves, you know, which of course is harder than it looks. We all are radically ourselves, but to put that in a form in a book in which somebody else can participate, that's a whole different, you know, lifelong struggle.
I guess that gets back to my first observation when we started talking about how it's, you know, it's not a self-help book, but it does get help you see the world in a different and see other people in a different, more empathetic, more compassionate, you know, when you spend so much time walking around somebody else's psychological skin, which is the beauty of fiction. I mean, you can't do that in a movie and you can't do that in a play. I think the written form is the only way that you really have access to people's interiority. And it just changes you. Yeah. I mean, it just changes how you see other people and how you participate in the world and how you feel when somebody's not wearing a mask at the store.
Yeah. I think so. And I think, you know, part of the beauty of it is that you're the form itself is kind of built around that idea. Like you meet the character on the first page and often you have a kind of what I would call a first draft opinion of that person, you know, like in Chekhov's great story, Lady with Pet Dog. There's this guy Gurov who's kind of a playboy, you know, and early in the story, you see that he's about to make another conquest and that never in his life has a conquest stayed with him more than a couple of days. And he just moves on. And so you kind of don't like him, you know, he's kind of a creep. And, but you feel in the story, in the fact that it is a story, the implicit promise that this might be the time that things change for him, you know? So you're kind of reading the whole story thinking, is he going to fall in love this time? And by the end of it, he appears to you as a totally different person. Which I think is kind of what happens in real life. You know, you see that person at the store with no mask and you have a projection about them and you might be largely right. You know, if you dwelt with them for 10 pages in story form, going into their thoughts, as you say, and you might still retain your original opinion of them as being selfish, but you'd also have some other stuff going on and the effect of that would be to complicate the notion selfish. You know, you'd see that selfish is actually, it actually breaks apart into several other concepts. And if there's any moral ethical value to it, it's that those subsidiary concepts are sometimes easier to work with, you know. That's one idea about fiction. Now, the other one is that, you know, you have to be careful because fiction does work as a kind of an empathy creator. There are times in life where, you know, we can engage in what I've heard called idiot compassion, where you're being so empathetic that somebody runs right over you. So it's complicated, but I believe as you do that basically it's empathy training wheels. It slows time down. So you can say, that's interesting. What layers are there to this person that in real life I wouldn't even spend a moment with, you know? I think there's value in that if you have the bandwidth for it.
Well, and it's really like the answer to social media. I mean, social media is the exact opposite, right? Which is everybody showing their selfies.
Yeah. Right? No, it's true. And, you know, and it's funny because that's a real, I mean, that's another way of looking at humanity is a bunch of people showing off on a corporate sanctioned platform, you know, and they're showing arguably not, you know, the very best part of themselves, but fiction is like the 180 degree inverse of that. Yeah.
I know we're running out of time, but that little anecdote about what the whole book is titled upon and this swim between Tolstoy and Chekhov, I thought was really very sweet. It was really lovely. And I thought maybe you could just talk about the title of the book and maybe tell that little story.
Yeah, well, it's from a Chekhov story called Gooseberries. And what happens is there's these two men who are out hunting and they get rained on and they go to a friend's house and they all bathe in this pond that's there. And while they're in there, it's raining. And one of the guys is just you know, has that moment of just deep sensual pleasure where he's out in the middle of the pond just going, my God, and they have to call him in because he's out there too long. And this is in a story that turns out to be mostly about whether happiness is a justifiable goal or not. And so in that moment, and in a few minutes, he gets out of the pond and makes this big speech against happiness, how happiness is corrupt and decadent and always built on the backs of unhappy people. It's a very convincing speech. But in that moment, you remember, wait a minute, you're the guy who was all blissed out in the pond, you know? So that kind of, I think that's such a beautiful example of what these stories can do, where they make completely powerful contradictory emotions and they just let those two resonate. They don't come down to one side or the other. They just put you in that conundrum. And I think that does something to your spirit. You're like, oh yeah. So things are always a little more complicated than we at first perceive. And it turns out that, you know, so that's a Chekhov story in it, but it turns out that, at least in my understanding, it came out of an actual swim in the pond between Tolstoy and Chekhov. And it was the first time they met. And charmingly, they both stripped off and jumped in the pond. And I think Chekhov was a little suspicious about Tolstoy because Tolstoy, unlike Chekhov, he had a lot of ideas that he put in his work. And he's a real, you know, prophetic kind of guy and very opinionated. And Chekhov was the opposite. He was very open and didn't really feel comfortable pronouncing. So Chekhov went into this swim thinking he wouldn't like Tolstoy, but was completely charmed by him. And so I named the book after that moment of beautiful ambiguity that I think the best stories build to. You know, we're all really good in real life at deciding what we think about things. That's what we do, you know. And if you're like me at a time like this one, I'm a little tired of that. I'm tired of having such facile opinions. I'm tired of the hostile position it puts me in, a kind of agitated state. And in fiction, through this highly artificial means, we produce moments in which we're stymied, you know, the kind of sacred confusion sets in, or ambiguity. And just for a few minutes afterwards, we get to be in that person. We get to be the person who doesn't know and isn't ashamed of not knowing. And I just feel like that's almost sacramental to do that every now and then, just to remind yourself that when you're positive, it's just your mind being positive, just this limited Darwinian tool, kind of, you know, going into a defensive posture to be sure that he's right. But we're capable of a little more than that. And fiction kind of just ceremonially reminds us of that now and then.
You have a great newsletter, which I just sit by my inbox and wait for. So in the spirit of where people can find you, they can sign up for your newsletter. And I'm sure you're still doing a ton of events where people can keep seeking you out. I know you're doing something with Selected Shorts. You had a great event with Tobias Wolff on Friday night. And I was lucky enough to sit in on your Lady with Pet Dog class, which was back in December. So I got an extra story in. I got 8 stories instead for the price of 7.
Yeah, that one, there was about 3 or 4 that I really wanted to put in the book, but it would have been, you know, 800 pages. But yeah, no, I still do a lot of public things. I'm kind of, you know, inclining a little bit in the other direction just as I get older. And I this book did a beautiful thing, which it made me fall in love with the story all over again. And then maybe a not so beautiful thing, which it made me look askance at my own production and kind of go, wow, you know, there's so much to do in this form and so little time left. So I can kind of see the appeal of just becoming a literary monk and just, you know, staying home. But I do like going out and meeting people and talking about these things. And it's very encouraging, you know, for a writer to see that mostly, you know, overwhelmingly the audience is rooting for you and they're positive and they enjoy what you do and they want you to succeed. And, you know, we're all kind of in the same undertaking together, so that's nice.
Well, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
And for me too. Thank you so much for what you do. It's beautiful.
That was George Saunders, the book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, published by Random House. It's out and available now. That's all the time we have for this week. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.